Welcome to Word on the Street, a weekly podcast from Barclays where our experts help ordinary investors make sense of the latest news and events impacting the world's financial markets.
Welcome back to another edition of Word on the Street. This week we have Will back to cover a very eventful first quarter for investments and of course some crystal ball gazing as to what might be coming next. War, interest rates and now broadening global economic recovery, all up for discussion. So let's start off with the highlights in terms of market returns.
Sophie, yes, good start. Funny enough, I got the team to give me what we call the patchwork quilt of asset class returns. And what it does, and regular clients will have seen this, it features in your kind of your review packs and so on. And what it does is it lists out our eight asset classes and it ranks them in what they returned each year from, you know, discrete years. And looking at the first quarter relative to all of the other years in the record, the lessons are sort of roughly similar. I mean, in a way, is that there are always different sources of return out there. You want to be very careful in assuming that the last year or the last years tells you much about what's coming. The key is diversification. But I think, you know, the story of this first quarter is really about, from an asset return perspective and an economics perspective, it's the resilience of the US economy. And that's taken a lot of people by surprise, but therefore at the top of the kind of asset class rankings, you see developed market stocks, emerging market stocks, and commodities all with positive returns so far this year. And the fixed income segment has been more subdued, as you might expect. The other thing just to point out is there's been a few surprises in amongst there. So, you know, particularly if you look towards the last month, there's been, as you just said in the introduction, there's been this broadening out in terms of returns. So for much of the first bit of the first quarter, it was really just about those seven stocks. And, you know, I think you and I talked about this before, you know, the so-called Magnificent Seven. But actually in the last month, what you've started to see in an equity market, you know, terms, looking underneath the bonnet and looking at the sectors and markets that have come, there's broadening participation from sort of some of the other sectors out there just beyond those very large dominant companies. So interesting, another interesting first quarter in terms of investment returns.
Yeah, and I think the other kind of thing that I guess we're coming back from essentially on that is last year we was in a position where investors were really braced for the lag effects of kind of interest rates and ready for that to strike the economy, but we haven't really seen that come about yet.
Yes, you are entirely right. And it was a bit sort of, you know, I think in 2023, the sort of commentary and investors entered it extremely negative, yeah, which allowed for a really kind of good setup. This year, it was a bit less negative, but you can still certainly, you know, speaking to a lot of colleagues around the industry, there was still a great deal of certainty that early this year, we'd see the price paid for those interest rate rises and that the economy was inevitably you know, going to buckle under the weight of those higher interest rates. This could be heroic hubris. You know, there always could be a recession or a shock around the corner. And it'll no doubt look obvious in hindsight to all the know-it-alls. But I think there was good reason to be fearful as we came into the year a little bit. You know, the untangling of pandemic era distortions, and they're still going, combined with that hostile monetary policy backdrop, that pushed, you know, many of the most trusted recession indicators. And I'm thinking here about, you know, the yield curve. So when people plot the path of interest rates, an inverting yield curve, when long interest rates or longer term interest rates are below those of the short term, that's supposed to be reliably, you know, indicating a recession ahead. And there's others as well. But so far, the mechanisms by which central bankers are supposed to be able to rein in their kind of economic charges, they've been blunted by a range of factors, some more predictable than the others. But I think, you know, the warning from us on this front is it's not just different this time, it's different every time. And I think that alongside the idea that some of the kind of organizing frameworks that people, investors have developed over many years in order to sort of try and make sense of the economy, those have been blown out of the water, which is always quite good, to be honest, you know, get everyone back to sort of, you know, believing that they know nothing, which is the right point to get on. But I think the thing that I would sort of take from it, and me and the team take from it a lot, is that if, as the old saying goes, you know, most economic cycles don't die of old age, then don't spend too much time trying to work out where we think it is in the, you know, where that life, where that economic cycle is in its own life cycle. You know, such frameworks are currently looking more confused than ever anyway. Like I said, you know, on the one hand, you've got credit spreads, you know, unemployment rates and assorted other indicators arguing for this cycle to have undergone kind of rapid aging. But on the other side, you've got, you know, signs of life in global manufacturing, industrial metals and some early cycle sectors such as chemicals, you know, combined with a very robust balance sheet for the US consumer and the developed world consumer. So, you know, consumers are, you know, pretty healthy in aggregate. Those things argue for a much more sort of youthful interpretation. So I think as usual, I would, or we would sort of reiterate that growth is the norm, not the exception. Try and sort of start off from looking at the economy as if, you know, innocent until proven guilty, as we say, and don't start from the other way, because that usually gets you in a mess, I think, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. So kind of when you're looking back at that kind of Q1 performance, is there anything that's changed for your perspective and the team's perspective in terms of how you're looking at the economy and investment markets?
Yes, I think a bit. Yeah, Sophie, no, so you're right. And we always talk about thinking about the future as a range of probable outcomes. And I think in the sort of beginning of the year, when we were sort of asked to put our thoughts down on what we thought was going to be the year ahead, we, as usual, we're real buzzkills about this. You know, we make it really boring and sort of, you know, probabilistic and don't make too many point forecasts and all that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, in my own head, I had a sort of, you know, a core scenario where the US economy continued to muddle through and sort of trundled along as, you know, as it is right now. There was a, you know, meltdown prospect, which was, you know, centered around all sorts of things that are still roughly there. And there was a kind of melt up idea where you could find this new batch of innovations starting to kickstart productivity growth and actually bring the US and global economy onto a higher plane. I think in terms of how my views and our views have shifted a bit since then, we'd probably have taken a little bit of a chunk in probability terms out of the meltdown scenario and probably transferred it into the melt up scenario, which sort of explains how asset markets have moved to a great degree with that sort of better equity market. So to a degree, we're sort of following markets a bit. But yes, I think in terms of the outlook, it's slightly brighter than it was, and there's a bit less inflation in it. So that's good, I think.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a world of two pictures. You've kind of got what's happening in markets, but then you kind of look to the rest of the world and there is kind of a lot of turbulence and tragedy at the moment. And how we're kind of factoring a lot of that into everything.
Yeah, Sophie, you know, I mean, we've talked about this, you know, yes, you're right. I mean, this was a quarter, again, you know, marred by tragedy in multiple parts of the world. And I think, you know, from an investment, the cold-hearted investments standpoint, you know, such kind of tragedies, they always kind of reveal a little bit about how the forecasting community thinks about the future. And it's revealed its kind of worst extrapolative tendencies. And what I mean by that is when something's happening, we almost always kind of use that moment and say, well, this is why it's going to continue forever like this. And usually getting worse, because that's sort of our tendency. I'm not sure that's the right way, you know, and we're fed by all manner of kind of geostrategic, geopolitical experts. And we've got in-house very high quality ones as well, but there are a load who aren't so high quality around the street, I would say. And they're going to tell you why this moment inevitably spells worse to come. The chaos of the multipolar world order is upon us and all sorts of other kind of confusing concepts. There's certainly much to worry about. I think I would make that point. And there's no cosmic requirement for humanity to build on the stunning progress of the last few centuries. Nonetheless, I think a close study of the last few hundred years would tilt us towards optimism, would be the way that I would put it. And central to humankind's remarkable success, and this may seem a bit abstract in the context of what's going on, but central to our success, which is, I think, under-acknowledged, is actually been our capacity for error correction. And this is one of the forces that often renders kind of extrapolative views of the future as, you know, way wider the mark and in terms of what happens. As we just lack the imagination to realize that we will ultimately, hopefully, find corrections to the way, and that unevenly gives you progress. The other point, and again, I think I've bored you on this before, it's historical again, but one of the sort of historical analogs, which I think is interesting, is the 1950s and 60s, where much of the developed world, so Europe and the US, was enjoying an economic boom. Now, this boom coincided with a dreadful period for the world in terms of sort of geopolitical tragedy, strife. You know, you can think about the Great Leap Forward in China, which cost tens of billions of lives, essentially. You know, that the estimates vary. You can see the Korean War, which we mentioned. You know, General MacArthur advised President Truman to drop 25 atom bombs on China. You know, you had Middle East turmoil, all those kind of Vietnam, France and US getting embroiled there. But what happened in markets was much more positive in a way, because markets were following what was going on in the real economy, and the real economy was being driven by a productivity surge. And then it was the arrival of sort of breakthroughs in polymer chemistry and various other things that sort of drove all sorts of consumer and other products and helped us become more productive. And it was that drove asset market returns, not the tragic, bloody, chaotic, you know, geopolitical backdrop. So it's not that these things can't matter. It's just somehow you have to work out how to sort of order them in importance, not as a human being. That's a different story. I'm talking as an investor in a sense, which is a necessarily more cold-hearted calculation.
Yeah, I mean, I won't pretend to be alive back in the 1950s and 60s, but it sounds like there was a lot going on back then, yes. as there is this year. And kind of, I guess, looking forward to the future, yes. We've got elections left, right and centre, India, the US here. What are your thoughts and kind of predictions coming up for that?
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of interesting ones. And, you know, obviously the US elections is getting a lot of airtime, as you'd expect, as the sort of drumbeat is drowning out almost everything else already. But in terms of India, I think India is quite interesting. It's an area where people are very excited about at the moment from an investment and sort of economic growth perspective. Even if you're not watching the IPL, which Himesh and I were just talking about, my children certainly enjoy. But, you know, it's a really interesting story, because what you've got there is also the private sector balance sheet is in quite robust health and private credit demand is going strong. And elections are expected here to bring a stable government, which, you know, versus one of, you know, our colleagues in Investment Bank highlighted that, you know, one of India's problems in past decades has been kind of fragmented coalition governments that made reforms harder. And if so goes the theory, you know, the Modi government gets a strong mandate, the stage should be set for all sorts of reforms in terms of, you know, increasing female participation in the labor force, you know, boosting the savings rate and infrastructure investment, all those kind of things, which could improve an already, you know, quite strong outlook. There is another side, though, I think, and it's something that's just worth bearing in mind with regards to sort of what people are calling the Gujarati model in terms of, you know, the Indian economy. And this is very much, you know, I guess for British centric listeners, it would be a sort of Indian version of Thatcherism, kind of neoliberalism. And it's a definite break with the sort of with the past in many ways. And what we saw from some of the problems focused last year around the Adani business connections is what you get is an economy where deep political connections matter for the companies. And what that means is, in a sense, as these companies become to a certain degree too big to fail, they know they're going to succeed because they've got these political connections, and that's the concern you have. And in an economy with low levels of literacy still, you know, controlling the media segment is quite important. You know, ownership of telcos and media is potentially more important. And I guess the worry you would have, because at the moment it's proving to be a good way, you know, an efficient way to get sort of quite a lot of the projects done, is, you know, do you get crony capitalism? You know, that idea that suddenly political connections trump, you know, your ability to compete as a company. And does that set the wrong incentives in the economy? And the sort of, you know, the worst case of this is obviously, or one of the sort of darker ideas of this is, you know, what you see in, for instance, you know, Russia, where you get a degeneration of the rule of law. And that's kind of, you know, something that you worry about a little bit. But, you know, if you go back, and again, we make this point regularly, you know, when the US economy was busy overtaking the rest of the developed world, most of the developed world would have looked at it and did look at it as a country with, you know, problematic crony capitalism, the robber barons of the time. You had, you know, not very good university system. As an economy, they were mainly capable of sort of nicking other people's intellectual property and sort of mass producing the results. So, you know, there is a path, I think. And at that point, people would have been writing off the US mistakenly. And I think people are getting excited with good reason about India. But it's just to sort of highlight some of the sort of threats of where that could go. And then US.
Yeah, US, UK.
I nearly got away with it. So I nearly got away with it. So I've got to try it. I mean, I think the main point with the US elections at the moment would be just not to get too fixated on the polls at this stage of the race. I mean, I think at roughly this stage in the 2016 race, Hillary Clinton had about a 10-point lead on Donald Trump. If you go back to 1992, even, you had Ross Perot, who you won't remember, but he was a third party candidate. He was a sort of Texan multimillionaire, maybe billionaire, I'm not sure. Multimillionaire, I think, probably. He was a big businessman anyway. And he was leading both G.W. Bush, the older George Bush, and the ultimate winner, Clinton, at this stage. So what I'm trying to say is that don't get too fixated on the polls. As the polls move closer to the election, you know, people tend to move away from kind of personality traits and more towards, you know, the fundamentals of the economy. That so goes the theory. There are people saying that there's differences now than the past, that people are now more partisan. There's that incredibly famous chart where you see how Democrats and Republicans feel about the economy, and it just crosses over on election day. So both suddenly feel that before even a policy has landed, that now they exist in a really bad economy versus, you know, the other side suddenly sees themselves good. So there is a very strong sort of partisan element, certainly. But yes, I think worth concentrating on a little bit later. There are potential implications from the US elections, but we would always make the point, and this is again goes back to sort of one of the starting points we were going on, is that these economies are way too big, too various, and too complicated to dance to the tune of one individual, whether that individual sits in the Oval Office or whether he or she is the Fed chair. You know, just be careful of sort of oversimplifying the drivers of the economy, I think.
Yeah, I think that sounds like it might be one for us to pick up on a later podcast.
I don't think I'll get away with that being the last comment I make on it, but yeah.
The other sort of, I guess, theme that we've kind of looked at over the last quarter is that kind of growing excitement towards technology. Has it been evolving as fast as you and the team expect? Faster? What's your thoughts?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's probably a bit faster. I mean, it does seem to be going a bit quicker. And I think we are seeing some sort of tangible, measurable, sort of practical examples of how, you know, large language models, for instance, and that's just one of the kind of technological breakthroughs that's, you know, the world is grappling with, can be applied, like I say, sort of productively. And some of the sort of productivity uplifts across a range of quite interesting sectors are starting to look quite quite interesting. It's not to say it's the finished article at all. There's all sorts of things still that, you know, need to be, and we talked about this before. But I think, you know, again, the reminder, you know, you are seeing a pickup in US productivity, measured productivity. It's probably too early for that to be chalked up to large language models. It could owe to something else, such as, you know, the big investments in software and hardware that happened during the pandemic and sort of some of the reorganizations of the workforce. That's maybe something that you're seeing in the US. But it does feel likely that large language models are going to be helpful somehow. But I think that, you know, the reminder from us is technology often moves in mysterious ways, you know, and much like with the economy, as we were discussing, we want to lean against our instinct to try and lean hard on history for organizing kind of rules and norms. The messages from the past, and there have been regularities to do with sort of productivity uplifts and new technology, you know, these tend to be good periods for investors in aggregate. But viewed 10 years from hence, looking back, my expectation would be that we would still be very surprised by some of the winners and losers from this new technology if we did get that sort of fast forward button, which we wouldn't want, I don't think.
So if we had that kind of fast forward button, as it were, I guess
my job would be a lot easier.
Yeah. If we were kind of, I guess, forecasting risk, I know that's something that you guys do kind of day in, day out. What are the kind of things that you're eyeing up kind of down the road, upside, downside? Obviously, tech plays into that. But what else is there that we should be keeping an eye on?
Oh, always loads of things, Sophie. I mean, you know, it's always difficult because there is, you know, during an economic cycle, you always get, you know, several things that look like they could be cycle killers. Ultimately, one does tend to turn out to be one, but there's many false alarms before that moment. At the moment, you know, in the US, which again is the one to watch for the business cycle. You know, a lot of people are still looking at this, you know, commercial property story. So particular in the office segment, where you've got that horrible mix of stuff going on. You know, you've got the return to work has been subdued, as elsewhere. Lots of people are working more from home. That combined with a sector which is generally, you know, highly leveraged, operating on very thin margins, you know, those kind of things. And you've got this big debt maturity wall coming down the pipe, which people are worried about, justifiably. And it could ripple up into something nastier, maybe. I mean, we're still not thinking that's our central scenario. It's just one of the risks to watch. You could also, you know, maybe we can't rule this out at all, that this, you know, maybe the lagged effects of interest rates do come due in sort of Q2 or Q3. And suddenly, you know, all those people calling you all clear look foolish again. Again, I think that's getting less likely a little bit, just because of some of the pickup in the lead indicators, but certainly not impossible. And again, you know, they're all sort of slightly associated points, but there are some segments of the consumer sort of household sector where, particularly in lower income segments, you're seeing some signs of stress. So, yeah, you know, you look at auto loans or credit card loans, and there's rising delinquencies in some of those spots. There's something to watch at the moment. And all of that is sort of very US specific. And then there's just the stuff that comes out of the blue. You know, I think, you know, we always used to characterize risk as like an iceberg. You can see the top tiny bit, but there's a huge lot that's submerged from view until you hit it. And that's just always the nature of things. It's just what's going to be enough to upset the economic apple cart sufficiently to, you know, stop that forward momentum.
Mm. I'm not sure I want to end on that analogy, but I do quite like it.
It's like an iceberg.
Yeah, yes. You never know what's going to be beneath
it. And we are not the Titanic. We're a much nimbler, should have been. Less self-confident or less overconfident.
Most definitely. But I think we'll wrap it up there for today. But thanks everyone so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
All investments can fall as well as rise in value, and their past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. This podcast is not a personal investment recommendation.